Wolf Hall, Disc 15.
2 days later, he's alone with Anne. She is tucked into a window embrasure, eyes closed, basking like a cat in a scarce shaft of winter sun. She stretches out her hand to him, hardly knowing who he is. Any man will do. He takes her fingertips. Her black eyes snap open. It's like a shop when the shutters are taken down. Good morning, Master Cromwell. What can we sell each other today?
I am tired of Mary, she says, and I would like to be rid of her.
Does she mean Catherine's daughter, the princess?
She should be married, she says, and out of my way. I never want to have to see her. I don't want to have to think about her. I have long imagined her married to some obscure person.
He waits, still wondering.
I don't suppose she would be a bad wife for somebody who was prepared to keep her chained to the wall.
Ah, Mary, your sister.
What did you think? Oh, she laughs. You thought I meant Mary the king's bastard. Well, now you put it in my mind. She should be married too. What age is she?
17 this year.
And still a dwarf.
Anne doesn't wait for an answer.
I shall find some old gentleman for her, some very honourable, feeble old gentleman, who will get no children on her, and whom I will pay to stay away from court. But as for Lady Carey, what is to be done? She cannot marry you. We tease her that you are her choice. Some ladies have a secret preference for common men. We say, Mary, oh, how you long to repose in the arms of the blacksmith. Even at the thought you are growing hot.
Are you happy? He asks her.
Yes.
She drops her eyes, and her small hands rest on her ribcage.
Yes, because of this, you see, she says slowly. I was always desired, but now I am valued. And that is a different thing, I find.
He pauses, to let her think her own thoughts, which he sees are precious to her.
So, she says, you have a nephew Richard, a Tudor of sorts, though I am sure I cannot understand how that came about.
I can draw out for you the tree of descent. She shakes her head, smiling.
I wouldn't give you the trouble. Since this,
her fingers slip downwards,
I wake up in the morning, and I scarcely remember my name. I always wondered why women were foolish, and now I know.
You mentioned my nephew.
I have seen him with you. He looks a determined boy. He might do for her. What she wants are furs and jewels. You can give her those, can't you? And a child in the cradle every other year. As for who fathers it, you can make your own household arrangements about that.
I thought, he says, that your sister had an attachment. He doesn't want revenge, just clarification.
Does she? Oh, well, Mary's attachments, usually passing and sometimes very odd, as you know, don't you?
It's not a question.
Bring them to court, your children. Let's see them.
He leaves her, eyes closing again, edging into marginal warmth, the small sort of sunbeam that is all February offers. The king has given him lodgings within the old palace at Westminster, for when he works too late to get home. This being so, he has to walk mentally through his rooms at Austin Friars, picking up his memory images from where he has left them on windowsills and under stools and in the woolen petals of the flowers strewn in the tapestry at Anselma's feet. At the end of a long day, he takes supper with Cranmer and with Roland Lee, who stamps between the various working parties, urging them along. Sometimes Audley joins them, the Lord Chancellor, but they keep no state, just sit down like a bunch of inky students and talk till it's Cranmer's bedtime. He wants to work them out, these people, test how far he can rely on them, and find out their weaknesses. Audley is a prudent lawyer who can sift a sentence like a cook sifting a sack of rice for grit. An eloquent speaker, he is tenacious of a point and devoted to his career. Now that he's Chancellor, he aims to make an income to go with the office. As for what he believes, it's up for negotiation. He believes in Parliament, in the King's power, exercised in Parliament, and in matters of faith, Let's say his convictions are flexible. As for Lee, he wonders if he believes in God at all, though it doesn't stop him having a bishopric in his sights. He says, "Roland, will you take Gregory into your household? I think Cambridge has done all that it can for him, and I admit that Gregory has done nothing for Cambridge." "I'll take him up the country with me," Roland says, "when I go to have a row with the northern bishops. He is a good boy, Gregory. Not the most forward, but I can understand that. We'll make him useful yet."
"You don't intend him for the church?" Cranmer asks.
"I said," growls Roland, "we'll make him useful." At Westminster, his clerks are in and out with news and gossip and paperwork, and he keeps Christoph with him, supposedly to look after his clothes, but really to make him laugh. He misses the music they have nightly at Austin Friars, and the women's voices heard from other rooms. He is at the Tower most days of the week, persuading the foremen to keep their men working through frost and rain, checking the paymaster's accounts, and making a new inventory of the king's jewels and plate. He calls on the wardens of the mint and suggests a spot check on the weight of the king's coinage. "What I should like to do," he says, "is make our English coins so sound that the merchants over the sea won't even bother weighing them." "Do you have authority for this?" "Why? What are you hiding?" He has written a memorandum for the king, setting out the sources of his yearly revenues, and detailing through which government offices they pass. It is remarkably concise. The king reads it and reads it again. He turns the paper over to see if anything convoluted and inexplicable is written on the back. But there is nothing more than meets his eye. "It's not news," he says, half apologetic. "The late cardinal carried it in his head. I shall keep calling at the mint, if your majesty pleases." At the Tower, he calls on a prisoner, John Frith. At his request, which does not count for nothing, the prisoner is cleanly kept above ground with warm bedding, sufficient food, a supply of wine, paper, ink, though he has advised him to put away his writing if he hears the key in his lock. He stands by while the turnkey admits him, his eyes on the ground, not liking what he's going to see. But John Frith rises from his table, a gentle, slender young boy, a scholar in Greek, and says, "Master Cromwell, I knew you would come." When he takes Frith's hands, he finds them all bones, cold and dry, and with telltale traces of ink. He thinks, he cannot be so delicate if he's lived so long. He was one of the scholars shut in the cellar at Wolsey's College, where the Bible men were held because there was no other secure place. When the summer plague struck underground, Frith lay in the dark with the corpses till someone remembered to let him out. "Master Frith," he says, "if I had been in London when you were taken..."
"But while you were in Calais, Thomas More was at work."
"What made you come back into England? No, don't tell me. If you were going about Tyndale's work, I'd better not know it. They say you've taken a wife, is that correct? In Antwerp?" "The one thing the king cannot abide..." "No, many things he cannot abide. But he hates married priests. And he hates Luther, and you have translated Luther into English."
"You put the case so well, for my prosecution."
"You must help me to help you. If I could get you an audience with the king, you would have to be prepared. He is a most astute theologian. Do you think you could soften your answers to accommodate him?"
The fire is built up, but the room is still cold. You cannot get away from the mists and exhalations of the Thames.
Frith says, his voice barely audible,
"Thomas More still has some credit with the king, and he has written him a letter saying,"
he manages to smile,
"that I am Wycliffe, Luther, and Zwingli rolled together and tied up in string, one reformer stuffed inside another, as for a feast you might parcel a pheasant inside a chicken, inside a goose. More means to dine on me, so do not injure your credit by asking for mercy. As for softening my answers, I believe, and I will say before any tribunal..."
"Do not, John."
"I will say before any tribunal
what I will say before my last judge. The Eucharist is but bread. Of penance we have no need. Purgatory is an invention ungrounded in Scripture. If some men come to you and say, Come with us, Frith, you go with them. They will be my men. You think you can take me out of the tower? Tyndale's Bible says, With God shall nothing be impossible. If not out of the tower, then when you are taken to be questioned, that will be your chance. Be ready to take it. But to what purpose? Frith speaks kindly, as if speaking to a young pupil. You think you can keep me at your house and wait for the king to change his mind? I should have to break out of there and walk to Paul's Cross and say, before the Londoners, what I've already said. Your witness cannot wait. Not on Henry. I might wait till I was old. They will burn you. And you think I cannot bear the pain? You are right, I cannot. But they will give me no choice. As Moore says, it hardly makes a man a hero to agree to stand and burn once he is chained to a stake. I have written books, and I cannot unwrite them. I cannot unbelieve what I believe. I cannot unlive my life. He leaves him. 4 o'clock. The river traffic sparse, a fine and penetrative vapour creeping between air and water. Next day, a day of crisp blue cold, the king comes down in the royal barge to see the progress of the work with the new French envoy. They are confidential, the king walking with a hand on de Danteville's shoulder, or rather on his padding. The Frenchman is wearing so many layers that he seems broader than the doorways, but he's still shivering. Our friend here must get some sport to warm his blood, the king says. And he is a bungler with the bow. When we went into the butts last, he shook so much, I thought he would shoot himself in the foot. He complains we are not serious falconers, so I have said he shall go out with you, Cromwell. Is this a promise of time off? The king strolls away and leaves them. Not if it's cold like this, the envoy says. I'm not standing in a field with the wind whistling. It will be the death of me. When shall we see the sun again? Oh, about June. The falcons will be molting by then. I aim to have mine flying again in August, so nil desperanda, monsieur. We shall have some sport. You wouldn't postpone this coronation, would you? It's always so. After a little chaff and chat, out of his mouth pops an ambassador's purpose. Because when my master made the treaty, he didn't expect Henry to be flaunting his supposed wife and her big belly. If he were to keep her quietly, it would be a different matter. He shakes his head. There will be no postponement. Henry claims he has the support of the bishops, the nobles, judges, parliament, and the people. Anne's coronation is his chance to prove it. Never mind, he says. Tomorrow we entertain the papal nuncio. You will see how my master will manage him. Henry calls down to them from the walls. Come up here, sir. See the prospect of my river. Do you wonder I shake? The Frenchman says with passion. Do you wonder I tremble before him? My river, my city, my salvation, cut out and embroidered just for me? My personally tailored English god. He swears under his breath and begins to climb. When the papal nuncio comes to Greenwich, Henry takes him by the hand and tells him frankly how his ungodly counsellors torment him and how he longs for a return of perfect amity with Pope Clement. You could watch Henry every day for a decade and not see the same thing. Choose your prince. He admires Henry more and more. Sometimes he seems hapless, sometimes feckless, sometimes a child, sometimes master of his trade. Sometimes he seems an artist, in the way his eye ranges over his work. Sometimes his hand moves, and he doesn't seem to see it move. If he had been called to a lower station in life, he could have been a travelling player and leader of his troupe. At Anne's command, he brings his nephew to court, Gregory, too. Ralph, the king, already knows, for he is always at his elbow. The king stands gazing for a long time at Richard. "I see it. Indeed I do." There is nothing in Richard's face, as far as he can see, to show that he has Tudor blood, but the king is looking at him with the eye of a man who wants relatives. "Your grandfather, Ap Evan, the archer, was a great servant to the king, my father. You have a fine build. I should like to see you in the tilt-yard. I should like to see you carry your colours in the joust." Richard bows, and then the king, because he is the essence of courtesy, turns to Gregory and says, "And you, Master Gregory, you are a very fine young man too." As the king walks away, Gregory's face opens in simple pleasure. He puts his hand on his arm, the place the king has touched, as if transferring regal grace to his fingertips. "He's very splendid. He's so splendid, beyond anything I ever thought. And to speak to me!" He turns to his father. "How do you manage to speak to him every day?" Richard gives him a sideways look. Gregory thumps him on the arm. "Never mind your grandfather, the archer. What would he say if he knew your father was that big?" He shows between finger and thumb the stature of Morgan Williams. "I've been riding at the ring these many years. I've been riding at the Saracen's image and putting my lance just so, thud, right over his black Saracen's heart." "Yes," Richard says patiently. "But, Squib, you will find a living knight a tougher proposition than a wooden infidel. You never think of the cost. Armour of show quality, a stable of trained horses." "We can afford it," he says. "It seems our days as foot soldiers are behind us." That night at Austin Friars, he asks Richard to come to speak with him alone after supper. Possibly he is at fault in putting it as a business proposition, spelling out to him what Anne has suggested about his marriage. "Build nothing on it. We have yet to get the king's approval." Richard says, "But she doesn't know me." He waits for objections. "Not knowing someone, is that an objection?" "I won't force you." Richard looks up. "Are you sure?" When have I ever forced anyone to do anything?" he starts to say. But Richard cuts in. "No, you don't. I agree. It's just that you are practiced at persuading, and sometimes it's quite difficult, sir, to distinguish being persuaded by you from being knocked down in the street and stamped on." "I know Lady Carey is older than you, but she is very beautiful. I think the most beautiful woman at court. And she is not as witless as everyone thinks, and she has not got any of her sister's malice in her." In a strange way, he thinks, she has been a good friend to me. "And instead of being the king's unrecognised cousin, you would be his brother-in-law. We would all profit." "A title, perhaps, for me and for you. Brilliant matches for Alice and Joe. What about Gregory? A countess at least for him." Richard's voice is flat. Is he talking himself into it? It's hard to tell. With many people, most people perhaps, the book of their heart lies open to him. But there are times when it's easier to read outsiders than your own family. "And Thomas Boleyn would be my father-in-law, and Uncle Norfolk would really be our uncle." "Imagine his face." "Oh, his face. Yes, one would go barefoot over hot coals to see his expression." "Think about it. Don't tell anybody." Richard goes out with a bob of the head, but without another word. It seems he interprets "don't tell anybody" as "don't tell anybody but Ralph," because 10 minutes later Ralph comes in and stands looking at him with his eyebrows raised. Red-headed people can look quite strained when they are raising eyebrows that aren't really there. He says, "You need not tell Richard that Mary Boleyn once proposed herself to me. There's nothing between us. It won't be like Wolf Hall, if that's what you're thinking." "And what if the bride thinks different? I wonder you don't marry her to Gregory." "Gregory is too young. Richard is 23. It is a good age to marry if you can afford it. And you have passed it. It's time you married too. I'm going before you find a Berlin for me. Rafe turns back and says softly, Only this, sir. And I think it is what gives Richard pause. All our lives and fortunes depend now on that lady. And as well as being mutable, she's mortal. And the whole history of the king's marriage tells us a child in the womb is not an heir in the cradle. In March, news comes from Calais that Lord Berners has died. The afternoon in his library, the storm blowing outside. It seems when he looks back, a haven of peace, the last hour he had to himself. He wants to make an offer for his books, a generous one to help Lady Berners. But the folios seem to have jumped off their desks and walked. Some in the direction of Francis Bryan, the old man's nephew, and some to another connection of his, Nicholas Carew. "Would you forgive his debts?" he asks Henry. "At least for his wife's lifetime. You know he leaves. No sons." Henry's mind has moved ahead. "Once I was in that unhappy state, no sons, but soon I shall have my heir." He brings Anne some Majolica bowls. The word Maschio is painted on the outside, and inside are pictures of plump, blonde-haired babies, each with a coy little phallus. She laughs. The Italians say for a boy, you have to keep warm, he tells her. Heat up your wine to heat up your blood. No cold fruit, no fish. Jane Seymour says, Do you think it's already decided what it will be, or does God decide later? Do you think it knows itself, what it is? Do you think if we could see inside you, we would be able to tell? Jane, I wish you were still down in Wiltshire, Mary Shelton says. Anne says, You needn't cut me up, Mistress Seymour. It is a boy, and no one is to say or think otherwise. She frowns, and you can see her bending, concentrating the great force of her will. I'd like a baby, Jane says. Watch yourself, Lady Rochford tells her. If your belly shows, mistress, we'll have you bricked up alive. In her family, Anne says, they'd give her a bouquet. They don't know what continence means down at Wolf Hall. Jane is flushed and trembling. I meant no harm. Leave her, Anne says. It's like baiting a field mouse. She turns to him. Your bill is not passed yet. Tell me, what is the delay? The bill, she means, to forbid appeals to Rome. He begins to explain to her the strength of the opposition, but she raises her eyebrows and says, My father is speaking for you in the Lords, and Norfolk. So who dare oppose us? I shall have it through by Easter, depend upon it. The woman we saw in Canterbury, they say her people are printing a book of her prophecies. That may be, but I shall make sure that no one reads it. They say on St. Catherine's Day last, while we were at Calais, she saw a vision of the so-called Princess Mary crowned queen. Her voice runs on, fluid, rapid. These are my enemies, this prophetess and those about her, Catherine, who is plotting with the Emperor, her daughter Mary, the supposed heir, Mary's old governess, Margaret Pole, Lady Salisbury, she and all her family are my enemies, her son, Lord Montague, her son, Reginald Pole, who is abroad. People talk of his claim to the throne, so why can he not be brought back, his loyalty examined? Henry Courtenay, the Marquis of Exeter, he believes he has a claim, but when my son is born, that will put him out of his conceit. Lady Exeter, Gertrude, she's forever complaining that noblemen are being put down from their places by men of low birth, and you know who she means by that. My lady, her sister, says softly, do not distress yourself. I am not distressed, Anne says. Her hand over the growing child, she says calmly. These people want me dead. The days are still short, the king's temper shorter. Chapuis bows and writhes before him, twisting and grimacing, as if he had in mind to ask Henry to dance.
I have read with some perplexity certain conclusions reached by Dr. Cranmer.
My Archbishop, the King says coldly. A great expense. The anointing has taken place.
Conclusions regarding Queen Catherine.
Who? You mean my late brother's wife, the Princess of Wales?
For your Majesty knows that dispensations were issued in such form as to allow your own marriage to be valid, whether or no that former marriage was consummated.
I do not want to hear the word dispensation, Henry says. I do not want to hear you mention what you call my marriage. The Pope has no power to make incest licit. I am no more Catherine's husband than you are. Chapuis bows. If the contract had not been void, Henry says, patient for the last time, God would not have punished me with the loss of my children.
We do not know the Blessed Catherine is beyond childbearing.
He looks up with a sly, delicate glance. Tell me, why do you think I do this? The king sounds curious. Out of lust? Is that what you think? Kill a cardinal? Divide your country? Split the church?
It seems extravagant,
Chapuis murmurs. But that is what you think. That is what you tell the emperor. You are wrong. I am the steward of my country, sir. And if I now take a wife in a union blessed by God, it is to have a son by her.
But there is no guarantee that your Majesty will have a son, or any living children at all.
Why would I not? Henry reddens. He is on his feet, shouting, angry tears spilling down his face. Am I not a man like other men? Am I not? Am I not? He is a game little terrier, the Emperor's man. But even he knows that when you've made a king cry, it's time to back off. On the way out, he says, dusting himself down with his accustomed self-deprecatory flutter,
There is a distinction to be drawn between the welfare of the country and the welfare of the Tudor line. Or do you not think so?
So who is your preferred candidate for the throne? You favour Courtney or Pole?
You should not sneer at persons of royal blood.
Chapuis shakes out his sleeves.
At least now I am officially informed of the lady's state, whereas before I could only deduce it from certain spectacles of folly I had witnessed. Do you know how much you are staking, Cromwell, on the body of one woman? Let us hope no evil comes nearer, eh?
He takes the ambassador by the arm, wheels him around. What evil? Say what you mean.
If you would let go your crepe on my jacket. Thank you. Very soon, you resort to manhandling people, which shows, as they say, your breeding.
His words are full of bravado, but he is trembling.
Look around you and see how, by her pride and presumption, she offends your own nobility. Her own uncle has no stomach for her tricks. The king's oldest friends make excuses to stay away from court.
Wait till she's crowned, he says. Watch them come running. On the 12th of April, Easter Sunday, Anne appears with the king at High Mass and is prayed for as Queen of England. His bill went through Parliament just yesterday. He expects a modest reward. And before the royal party go in to break their fast, the king waves him over and gives him Lord Berners' old post, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Berners suggested you for it. Henry smiles. He likes giving. Like a child, he enjoys anticipating how pleased you will be. During Mass, his mind had wandered through the city. What noisome goose houses have they waiting for him at home? What rows in the street? What babies left on church steps? What unruly apprentices with whom he will please have a word? Have Alice and Joe painted Easter eggs? They are too grown up now, but they are content to be the children of the house until the next generation comes along. It's time he put his mind to husbands for them. Anne, if she had lived, could be married by now, and to Rafe, as he is still not spoken for. He thinks of Helen Barr, how fast she gets on with her reading, how they cannot do without her at Austin Friars. He believes now that her husband is dead, and he thinks, I must talk to her. I must tell her she is free. She is too proper to show any pleasure. But who would not like to know that she is no longer subject to a man like that? Through Mass, Henry keeps up a constant buzz of talk. He sorts papers and passes them up and down to his counsellors. Only at the consecration does he throw himself to his knees in a fever of reverence, as the miracle takes place and a wafer becomes God. As soon as the priest says, Ita missa est, he whispers, Come to me in my closet alone. First, the assembled courtiers must make their bows to Anne. Her ladies sweep back and leave her alone in a little sunlit space. He watches them, watches the gentlemen and counsellors, among whom, on this feast day, are many of the king's boyhood friends. He watches Sir Nicholas Carew in particular. Nothing is wanting in his reverence to his new queen, but he cannot help a downturn of his mouth. Arrange your face, Nicholas Carew, your ancient family face. He hears Anne saying, These are my enemies. He adds Carew to the list. Behind the chambers of state are the king's own rooms, which only his intimates see, where he is served by his gentlemen, and where he can be free of ambassadors and spies. This is Henry Norris's ground, and Norris gently congratulates him on his new appointment and moves away, soft-footed. You know Cranmer is to convene a court to make a formal dissolution of the... Henry has said he does not want to hear any more about his marriage, so he will not even say the word. I've asked him to convene at the Priory at Dunstable, because it is, what, 10, 12 miles to Ant Hill, where she is lodged. So she can send her lawyers, if she likes, or come to the court herself. I want you to go to see her, go secretly, just talk to her. Make sure she springs no surprises. Leave Rafe with me while you are gone. At being so easily understood, the king relaxes into good humour. I can rely on him to say what Cromwell would say. You have a good boy there, and he is better than you are at keeping his face straight. I see you, when we sit in council, with your hand before your mouth. Sometimes, you know, I want to laugh myself. He drops into a chair, covers his face as if to shade his eyes. He sees that once again the king is about to cry. Brandon says my sister is dying. There's no more the doctors can do for her. You know that fair hair she had once? Hair like silver. My daughter had that. When she was 7, she was the image of my sister, like a saint painted on a wall. Tell me, what am I to do with my daughter? He waits, till he knows it is a real question. Be good to her, sir. Conciliate her. She should not suffer. But I must make her a bastard. I need to settle England on my lawful children. A parliament will do it. Yes, he sniffs, scrubs his tears away. After Anne is crowned. Cromwell, one thing, and then we will have our breakfast, because I'm really very hungry. This project of a match for my cousin Richard. He thinks his way rapidly around the nobility of England. But no, he sees it's his Richard, Richard Cromwell. Lady Carey, the king's voice softens. Well, I have thought it over, and I think no. Or at least not at this time. He nods. He understands his reason. When Anne understands it, she will spit nails. Sometimes it is a solace to me, Henry says, not to have to talk and talk. You were born to understand me, perhaps. That is one view of their situations. He was 6 years or so in this world before Henry came into it, years of which he made good use. Henry takes off his embroidered cap, throws it down, runs his hands through his hair. Like Wyatt's golden mane, His hair is thinning, and it exposes the shape of his massive skull. For a moment he seems like a carved statue, like a simpler form of himself, or one of his own ancestors, one of the race of giants that roamed Britain and left no trace of themselves except in the dreams of their petty descendants. He goes back to Austin Friars as soon as he can get away. Surely he can have one day off. The crowds outside his gate have dispersed, as Thurston has fed them an Easter dinner. He goes out to the kitchen first to give his man a slap on the head and a gold piece.
100 open moors, I swear, Thurston says. And by supper time they'll be round again.
It is a shame there should be beggars.
Beggars, my arse. What comes out of this kitchen is so good, there are aldermen out there with their hoods up so we don't know them. And I have a houseful here. Whether you are with us or not, I have Frenchmen, Germans, I have Florentiners. They all claim to know you, and they all want their dinner to their own liking. I have their servants down here, pinch of that, soup's on of the other. We must feed fewer or build another kitchen.
I'll get it in hand.
Master Rafe says for the tower, you've bought out the whole of a quarry in Normandy. He says the Frenchmen are all undermined and dropping into holes in the ground.
Such beautiful stone, the colour of butter. 400 men on the payroll, and anyone standing about instantly redeployed to the building work at Austin Friars.
Thurston, don't let anybody put pinches or soupçons in our dinner.
He thinks that's how Bishop Fisher nearly died, unless it was an unboiled stockpot after all. You could never fault Thurston's stockpot. He goes and views it, bubbling away. Where is Richard, do you know?
Chopping onions on the back step. Oh, you mean Master Richard, upstairs, eating. Where's anybody?
He goes up. The Easter eggs he sees bear his own unmistakable features. Joe has painted his hat and his hair in one, so he seems to be wearing a cap with ear flaps. She's given him at least two chins.
Well, sir, Gregory says, it is true you are getting stout. When Stephen Vaughan was here, he could not believe you.
My master, the Cardinal, waxed like the moon, he says.
It is a mystery, because he hardly sat down to dine, but he would be leaping up to deal with some exigency. And even when he was at the table, he could hardly eat for talking. I feel sorry for myself. I have not broken bread since last night.
He breaks it and says,
Hans wants to paint me.
I hope he can run fast, Richard says.
Richard,
have your dinner.
My breakfast. No, never mind it. Come.
The happy bridegroom,
Gregory says, taunting.
You, his father threatens him, are going north with Roland Lee. If you think I'm a hard man, wait till you meet Roland.
In his office, he says, How is your practice in the lists?
Good.
Cromwell's will knock down all comers.
He's afraid for his son, that he will fall, be maimed, be killed.
Afraid for Richard, too. These boys are the hope of his house. Richard says,
So am I, the happy bridegroom?
The king says no. It's not because of my family or your family. He calls you his cousin. He is, at this moment, his disposition to us, I would say, it is excellent. But he needs Mary for himself. The child is due in late summer, and he's afraid to touch Anne. And he does not wish to resume his celibate life.
Richard looks up.
He said this?
He left me to understand it. And as I understand it, I convey it to you, and we are both amazed. But we get over it.
I suppose if the sisters were more alike, one could begin to understand it.
I suppose, he says, one could.
And he is the head of our church. No wonder foreigners laugh.
If he were a model of conduct in his private life, one would be surprised. But for me, you see, I can only concern myself with his kingship. If he were oppressive, if he were to override Parliament, if he were to pay no heed to the Commons and govern only for himself. But he does not. So I cannot concern myself with how he behaves to his women.
But if he were not king...
Oh, I agree. You'd have him locked up. But again, Richard, leave aside Mary, and he has behaved well enough. He hasn't filled a nursery with his bastards, as the Scottish kings do. There have been women. But who can name them? Only Richmond's mother and the Boleyns. He has been discreet. I dare say Catherine knew their names. Who can say he will be a faithful husband? Will you? I may not get the chance. On the contrary. I have a wife for you. Thomas Murfin's girl. A Lord Mayor's daughter is not a bad prospect. And your fortune will more than match hers. I will make sure of that. And Frances likes you. I know because I have asked her. You have asked my wife to marry me? Since I was dining there yesterday. No point in delay, was there? Not really. Richard laughs. He stretches back in his chair. His body, his capable, admirable body, which has impressed the king so much, is rinsed with relief. Francis. Good. I like Francis. Mercy approves. He cannot think how she would have taken to Lady Carey. He had not broached the topic with the women. She says, "Don't leave it too long to make a match for Gregory. He is very young, I know, but some men never grow up until they have a son of their own." He hasn't thought about it, but it might be true. In that case, there's hope for the Kingdom of England. 2 days later, he is back at the Tower. The time goes quickly between Easter and Whit, when Anne will be crowned. He inspects her new apartments and orders in braziers to help dry out the plaster. He wants to get on with the frescoes. He wishes Hans would come down, but he is painting de Danteville and says he needs to push on with it, as the ambassador is petitioning Francis for his recall, a whining letter on every boat. For the new queen, we are not going to have those hunting scenes you see painted everywhere, or grim virgin saints with the instruments of their torture, but goddesses, doves, white falcons, canopies of green leaves. In the distance, cities seated on the hills. In the foreground, temples, groves, fallen columns, and hot blue skies, delineated as within a frame by borders of Vitruvian colours, quicksilver and cinnabar, burnt ochre, malachite, indigo and purple. He unrolls the sketches the craftsmen have made. Minerva's owl spreads her wings across a panel. A barefoot Diana fits an arrow to her bow. A white doe watches her from the trees. He scribbles a direction to the overseer. Arrow to be picked out in gold. All goddesses have dark eyes. Like a wingtip from the dark, dread brushes him. What if Anne dies? Henry will want another woman. He will bring her to these rooms. Her eyes may be blue. We will have to scour away the faces and paint them again, against the same cities, the same violet hills. Outside, he stops to watch a fight. A stonemason and the bricklayer's gaffer are swiping at each other with batons. He stands in the ring with the trowel men. What's it about?
Nothing. Stone men have to fight brick men. Like Lancaster and York. Like that.
Have you ever heard of the field called Towton? The king tells me more than 20,000 Englishmen died. The man gawps at him.
Who were they fighting?
Each other. It was Palm Sunday, the year 1461. The armies of two kings met in the driving snow. King Edward, the king's grandfather, was the winner, if you can say there was a winner at all. Corpses made a bobbing bridge across the river. Uncounted numbers crawled away, rolled and tumbled in their own blood. Some blinded, some disfigured, some maimed for life. The child in Anne's womb is the guarantee of no more civil war. He is the beginning, the start of something, the promise of another country. He walks into the fight. He bellows at them to stop. He gives them both a push, and they bowl over backwards. Two crumbly Englishmen, snappable bones, chalky teeth. Victors of Agincourt. He's glad Chapuis isn't there to see. The trees are in full leaf when he rides into Bedfordshire, with a small train on unofficial business. Christophe rides beside him and pesters him. You have said you will tell me who is Cicero,
and who is Reginald Pole?
Cicero was a Roman.
A general?
No, he left that to others, as I, for example, might leave it to Norfolk.
Oh, Norfolk.
Christoph subjects the Duke to his peculiar pronunciation.
He is one who pisses on your shadow.
Dear God, Christoph. I've heard of spitting on someone's shadow.
Yes, but we speak of Norfolk. And Cicero?
We lawyers try to memorize all his speeches. If any man were walking around today with all of Cicero's wisdom in his head, he would be what? Cicero would be on the king's side, he says. Christoph is not much impressed.
Paul, he is a general?
A priest. That is not quite true. He has offices in the church, but he has not been ordained.
Why not?
No doubt so he can marry. It is his blood that makes him dangerous. He is a Plantagenet. His brothers are here in this kingdom under our eye. But Reginald is abroad, and we are afraid he is plotting with the Emperor.
Send one to kill him. I will go.
No, Christoph. I need you to stop the rain spoiling my hats.
As you wish.
Christoph shrugs.
But I will kill a Pole when you require it. Will be my pleasure.
The manor at Ampt Hill, once fortified, has airy towers and a splendid gatehouse. It stands on a hill with views over wooded countryside. It is a pleasant seat, the kind of house you'd visit after an illness to get your strength back. It was built with money gained in the French Wars, in the days when the English used to win them. To accord with Catherine's new status as Dowager Princess of Wales, Henry has trimmed her household, but still, she is surrounded by chaplains and confessors, by household officers, each with their own train of menials, by butlers and carvers, physicians, cooks, scullions, maltsters, harpers, lutenists, poultry keepers, gardeners, laundresses, apothecaries, and an entourage of wardrobe ladies, bedchamber ladies, and their maids. And when he is ushered in, she nods to her attendants to withdraw. No one had told her to expect him, but she must have spies on the road. Hence her nonchalant parade of occupation, a prayer book in her lap and some sewing. He kneels to her, nods towards these encumbrances.
Surely, madam, one or the other.
So English today. Get up, Cromwell. We will not waste our time, as at our last interview, selecting which language to use, because nowadays you are such a busy man.
Formalities over, she says.
First thing, I shall not attend your court at Dunstable. That is what you have come to find out, is it not? I do not recognize this court. My case is at Rome, awaiting the attention of the Holy Father.
Slow, isn't he? He gives her a puzzled smile.
I will wait.
But the king wishes to settle his affairs.
He has a man who will do it. I do not call him an archbishop.
Clement issued the bulls.
Clement was misled. Dr. Cranmer is a heretic.
Perhaps you think the king is a heretic?
No. Only a schismatic.
If a general council of the church were called, his majesty would submit to its judgment.
It will be too late if he is excommunicate and put outside the church.
We all hope, I'm sure you do, madam, that day will never come.
Nulla salus extra ecclesiam. Outside the church there is no salvation. Even kings come to judgment. Henry knows it and is afraid.
Madam, give way to him. For the present. Tomorrow, who knows? Do not cut off every chance of rapprochement.
I hear Thomas Boleyn's daughter is having a child.
Indeed, but Catherine, above anyone, should know that guarantees nothing. She takes his meaning, thinks about it, nods.
I see circumstances in which he might turn back to me. I have had much opportunity to study that lady's character, and she is neither patient nor kind.
It doesn't matter. She only has to be lucky. In the event they have no children, you should think of your daughter, Lady Mary. Conciliate him, madam.
He may confirm her as his heir, and if you will give way, he will offer you every honour and a great estate.
A great estate?
Catherine stands up. Her sewing slides from her skirts. The prayer book hits the floor with a fat, leathery thump, and a silver thimble goes skittering across the boards and rolls into a corner.
Before you make me any more preposterous offers, Master Cromwell, let me offer you a chapter from my history. After my Lord Arthur died, I passed 5 years in poverty. I could not pay my servants. We bought in the cheapest food we could find, coarse food, stale food, yesterday's fish. Any small merchant kept a better table than the daughter of Spain. The late King Henry would not let me go back to my father because he said he was owed money. He haggled over me like one of the doorstep women who sold us bad eggs. I put my faith in God. I did not despair, but I tasted the depth of humiliation.
So why would you want to taste it again? Face to face, they glare at each other. Assuming, he says, humiliation is all the king intends.
Say it plainly.
If you are found out in treason, the law will take its course with you, as if you were any other subject. Your nephew is threatening to invade us in your name.
That will not happen, not in my name.
That is what I say, madam. He softens his tone. I say the emperor is busy with the Turks. He's not so fond of his aunt, saving your presence, that he will raise another army. But others say, oh, be quiet, Cromwell, what do you know? They say we must fortify our harbours, we must raise troops, we must put the country in a state of alert. Chapuis, as you know, continually agitates with Charles to blockade our ports and impound our goods and our merchant ships abroad. He urges war in every dispatch.
I have no knowledge of what Chapuis puts in his dispatches.
It is a lie so staggering that he has to admire it. Having delivered it, Catherine seems weakened. She sinks down again into her chair, and before he can do it for her, she wearily bends from the waist to pick up her sewing. Her fingers are swollen, and bending seems to leave her breathless. She sits for a moment, recovering herself, and when she speaks again, she is calm, deliberate.
Master Cromwell, I know I have failed you. That is to say, I have failed your country, which by now is my country too. The king was a good husband to me, but I could not do that which is most necessary for a wife to do. Nevertheless, I am a wife. You see, do you, that it is impossible for me to believe that for 20 years I was a harlot? Now the truth is, I have brought England little good, but I would be loath to bring her any harm.
But you do, madam. You may not will it, but the harm is done.
England is not served by a lie.
That is what Dr. Cranmer thinks. So he will annul your marriage, whether you come to the court or not.
Dr. Cranmer will be excommunicated too. Does it not cause him a qualm? Is he so lost to everything?
This archbishop is the best guardian of the church, madam, that we have seen in many centuries. He thinks of what Baynham said before they burned him. In England, there have been 800 years of mystification, just 6 years of truth and light, 6 years since the gospel in English began to come into the kingdom. Cranmer is no heretic. He believes as the king believes. He will reform what needs reformation, that is all.
I know where this will end. You will take the church's lands and give them to the king.
She laughs.
Oh, you are silent. You will. You mean to do it.
She sounds almost light-hearted, as people do sometimes when they're told they're dying.
Master Cromwell, you may assure the king I will not bring an army against him. Tell him I pray for him daily. Some people, those who do not know him as I do, they say, oh, he will work his will. He will have his desire at any price. But I know that he needs to be on the side of the light.
He is not a man like you, who just packs up his sins in his saddlebags and carries them from country to country, and when they grow too heavy, whistles up a mule or two and soon commands a train of them and a troop of muleteers. Henry may err, but he needs to be forgiven. I therefore believe, and will continue to believe, that he will turn out of this path of error in order to be at peace with himself. And peace is what we all wish for, I am sure.
What a placid end you make, madam. Peace is what we all wish for. Like an abbess. You are quite sure, by the way, that you would not think of becoming an abbess. A smile. Quite a broad smile.
I shall be sorry if I don't see you again. You are so much quicker in conversation than the Duke's.
The Duke's will be back.
I am braced. Is there news of my Lady Suffolk?
The King says she is dying. Brandon has no heart for anything.
I can well believe it, she murmurs. Her income as Dowager, Queen of France, dies with her, and that is the greater part of his revenue. Still, no doubt, you will arrange him a loan at some iniquitous rate of interest. She looks up. My daughter will be curious to know I have seen you. She believes you were kind to her.
He only remembers giving her a stool to sit on. Her life must be bleak if she remembers that.
Properly, she should have remained standing, awaiting a sign from me.
Her own pain-racked little daughter. She may smile, but she doesn't yield an inch. Julius Caesar would have had more compunction. Hannibal.
Tell me, she says, testing the ground, the king would read a letter from me.
Henry has taken to tearing her letters up unread, or burning them. He says they disgust him with their expressions of love. He does not have it in him to tell her this.
Then rest for an hour, she says, while I write it. Unless you will stay a night with us, I should be glad of company at supper.
Thank you, but I must start back. The council meets tomorrow. Besides, if I stayed, where would I put my mules? Not to mention my team of drivers.
Oh, the stables are half empty. The king makes sure I am kept short of mounts. He thinks that I will give my household the slip and ride to the coast and escape on a ship to Flanders.
And will you? He has retrieved her thimble. He hands it back. She bounces it in her hand, as if it were a die, and she were ready to cast it.
No, I shall stay here, or go where I am sent, as the king wills, as a wife should.
Until the excommunication, he thinks. That will free you from all bonds, as wife, as subject. This is yours, too. He opens his palm. In it a needle, tip towards her. The word is about town that Thomas More has fallen into poverty. He laughs about it with Master Secretary Gardiner. Alice was a rich widow when he married her, Gardiner says. And he has land of his own. How can he be poor? And the daughters? He's married them well.
And he still has his pension from the king.
He is sifting through paperwork for Stephen, who is preparing to appear as leading counsel for Henry at Dunstable. He has filed away all the depositions from the Blackfriars hearings, which seem to have happened in another era.
Angels defend us, Gardiner says. Is there anything you don't file?
If we keep on to the bottom of this chest, I'll find your father's love letters to your mother. He blows dust off the last batch.
There you are.
The papers hit the table.
Stephen, what can we do for John Frith? He was your pupil at Cambridge. Don't abandon him.
But Gardiner shakes his head and busies himself with the documents, leafing through them, humming under his breath, exclaiming,
Well, who'd have known? And here's a nice point.
He gets a boat down to Chelsea. The ex-chancellor is at ease in his parlour, daughter Margaret translating from the Greek in a drone barely audible. As he approaches, he hears him pick her up on some error.
Leave us, daughter, More says, when he sees him. I won't have you in this devil's company.
But Margaret looks up and smiles, and More rises from his chair, a little stiff as if his back is bad, and offers a hand.
It is Reginald Pole, lying in Italy, who says he is a devil. Point is, he means it. It's not an image with him, as in a fable, but something he takes to be true, as he takes the gospel to be true. Well, he says, we hear you can't come to the coronation because you can't afford a new coat. The Bishop of Winchester will buy you one himself, if you'll show your face on the day.
Stephen, will he?
I swear it. He relishes the thought of going back to London asking Gardiner for £10. Or the guildsman will make a collection, if you like, for a new hat and a doublet as well. And how are you to appear? Margaret speaks gently, as if she's been asked to mind two children for the afternoon. They are making something for me. I leave it to others. If I only avoid exciting mirth, it will be enough. Anne has said, you shall not dress like a lawyer on my coronation day. She has called out to Jane Rochford, taking notes like a clerk. Thomas must go into crimson. Mistress Roper, he says, are you not yourself curious to see the Queen crowned? Her father cuts in, talking over her.
It is a day of shame for the women of England. One can hear them say on the streets when the Emperor comes, wives shall have their rights again.
Father, I am sure they take care not to say that in Master Cromwell's hearing. He sighs. It's not much to know that all the merry young whores are on your side, all the kept women and the runaway daughters. Though now Anne is married, she sets herself up for an example. Already she has slapped Mary Shelton, Lady Carey tells him, for writing a riddle in her prayer book, and it was not even an indecent one. The Queen sits very erect these days, child stirring in her belly, needlework in hand, and when Norris and Weston and their gentlemen friends come swarming into her apartments, she looks at them when they lay compliments at her feet, as if they were strewing her hem with spiders. Unless you approach her with a Bible text in your mouth, better not approach her at all. He says, has the maid been up to see you again, the prophetess?
She has, Meg says,
but we would not receive her. I believe she has been to see Lady Exeter at her invitation.
Lady Exeter is a foolish and ambitious woman, Moore says.
I understand the maid told her that she would be Queen of England.
I repeat my comment.
Do you believe in her visions? Their holy nature, that is?
No, I think she's an impostor. She does it for attention.
Just that?
You don't know what young women will do. I have a house full of daughters.
He pauses. You are blessed. Meg glances up. She recalls his losses, though she never heard Anne Cromwell demand, why should Mistress Moore have the preeminence? She says, there were holy maids before this, one at Ipswich, only a little girl of 12. She was of good family, and they say she did miracles, and she got nothing out of it, no personal profit, and she died young.
But then there was the Maid of Leinster, Moore says with gloomy relish. They say she is a whore at Calais now, and laughs with her clients after supper at all the tricks she worked on the believing people.
So he does not like holy maids. But Bishop Fisher does. He has seen her often. He has dealings with her. As if taking the words out of his mouth, Moore says,
of course, Fisher, he has his own views.
Fisher believes she has raised the dead. Moore lifts an eyebrow, but only for so long as it took the corpse to make his confession and get absolution. Then he fell down and died again. Moore smiles.
That sort of miracle.
Perhaps she's a witch, Meg says. Do you think so? There are witches in the scriptures. I could cite you.
Please don't.
Moore says,
Meg, did I show you where I put the letter?
She rises, marking with a thread her place in the Greek text.
I have written to this maid, Barton. Dame Elizabeth, we must call her, now she is a professed nun. I have advised her to leave the realm in tranquillity, to cease to trouble the king with her prophecies, to avoid the company of great men and women, to listen to her spiritual advisers, and, in short, to stay at home and say her prayers. As we all should, Sir Thomas, following your example. He nods vigorously. Amen. And I suppose you kept a copy? Get it, Meg, otherwise he may never leave.
Moore gives his daughter some rapid instructions, but he is satisfied that he is not ordering her to fabricate such a letter on the spot.
I would leave, he says, in time, but I'm not going to miss the coronation. I've got my new clothes to wear. Will you not come and bear us company?
You'll be company for each other in hell.
This is what you forget, this vehemence. His ability to make his twisted jokes but not take them.
The Queen looks well, he says. Your Queen, I mean, not mine. She seems very comfortable at Ant Hill. But you know that, of course.
Moore says, unblinking, I have no correspondence with the Princess Dowager.
Good, he says, because I am watching two friars who have been carrying her letters abroad. I am beginning to think that whole order of the Franciscans is working against the king. If I take them, and if I cannot persuade them, and you know I am very persuasive into confirming my suspicion, I may have to hang them up by their wrists and start a sort of contest between them as to which one will emerge first into better sense. Of course, my own inclination would be to take them home, feed them, and ply them with strong drink. But then, Sir Thomas, I have always looked up to you, and you have been my master in these proceedings.
He has to say it all before Margaret Roper comes back. He wraps his fingers on the table to make Moore sit up and pay attention. John Frith, he says, ask to see Henry. He will welcome you like a lost child. Talk to him, and ask him to meet Frith face to face.
I'm not asking you to agree with John. You think he's a heretic. Perhaps he is a heretic. I'm asking you to concede just this, and to tell it to the king, that Frith is a pure soul. He's a fine scholar. So let him live. If his doctrine is false and yours is true, you can talk him back to you. You are an eloquent man. You are the great persuader of our age. Not me. Talk him back to Rome if you can. But if he dies, you will never know, will you, if you could have won his soul.
Margaret's footstep.
Is this it, Father?
Give it to him.
There are copies of the copy, I suppose.
You would expect us, the girl says, to take all reasonable care.
Your father and I were discussing monks and friars. How can they be good subjects of the king if they owe their allegiance to the heads of their orders, who are abroad in other countries, and who are themselves perhaps subjects of the King of France or the Emperor?
I suppose they are still Englishmen.
I meet few who behave as such. Your father will enlarge on what I say.
He bows to her. He takes Moore's hand, holding its shifting sinews in his own palm. Scars vanish. It is surprising how they do. And now his own hand is white, a gentleman's hand, flesh running easily over the joints. Then once he thought the burn marks, the stripes that any smith picks up in the course of business would never fade. He goes home. Helen Barr meets him.
I've been fishing, he says, at Chelsea.
Catch more?
Not today.
Your robes came?
Yes.
Crimson.
Dear God, he laughs. Helen, she looks at him. She seems to be waiting. I haven't found your husband.
Her hands are plunged into the pocket of her apron. She shifts them, as if she were holding something. He sees that one of her hands is clutching the other.
So you suppose he is dead?
It would be reasonable to think so. I have spoken with a man who saw him go into the river. He seems a good witness.
So I could marry again, if anybody wanted me.
Helen's eyes rest on his face. She says nothing, just stands. The moment seems to last a long time. Then,
what happened to our picture? The one with the man holding his heart shaped like a book? Or do I mean his book shaped like a heart?
I gave it to a Genovese.
Why?
I needed to pay for an archbishop.
She moves, reluctant, slow. She drags her eyes from his face.
Hans is here. He's been waiting for you. He is angry. He says time is money.
I'll make it up to him.
Hans is taking time off from his preparations for the coronation. He's building a living model of Mount Parnassus on Gracechurch Street. And today, he has to put the nine muses through their paces, so he doesn't like being kept waiting by Thomas Cromwell. He's banging around in the next room. It seems he's moving the furniture. They take Frith to the Archbishop's palace at Croydon to be examined by Cranmer. The new Archbishop could have seen him at Lambeth, but the way to Croydon is longer and lies through the woods. In the depth of these woods, they say to him, "It would be a bad day for us if you were to give us the slip. For see how thick the trees are on the Wandsworth side. You could hide an army in there. We could spend 2 days searching there, more. And if you'd gone east, to Kent and the river, you'd be clear away before we got around to that side." But Frith knows his road. He's going towards his death. They stand on the path, whistling, talking about the weather. One pisses leisurely against the tree. One follows the flight of a jay through the branches. But when they turn back, Frith is waiting, placid, for his journey to resume.
This ends Disc 15.